Good morning. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded Musqueam territories on the University of British Columbia. It is first week. It's first day back at school. It's Imagine Day. There are a lot of people running around UBC right now. It's going to be a very hyped up day. And lucky for you, you get to listen to a bonus episode of Unceded Airwaves. Normally, it is on Mondays from 11 to 12 a.m., but today it's happening right now. So what we've been airing over the last few weeks is a special podcast series by Matthew Andrietta. He is an FNIS practicum student here at UBC, and he put together a podcast series called Rekindling Kinship. There have been two previous episodes. You can find the podcasts at Unceded Airwaves show page on CITR. And today we're going to be featuring a conversation that Matt had with Sarah Hunt talking about kinship relations. Now, my name is Madeline Taylor. I'm the program manager here at CITR. I am of Danish and British settler heritage. So I'm very grateful to Musqueam for allowing us to be uninvited guests on their land, and especially for today, for all the students that are milling around and doing the same. So without further ado, this is Rekindling Kinship with Sarah Hunt by Matt Andrietta on CITR 101.9 FM. And again, this is Unceded Airwaves.
Listening to a CITR Indigenous Source podcast series, Rekindling Kinship, in conjunction with the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program at UBC.
From unceded traditional Musqueam territory.
I'm your host, Matthew Andrietta, and over the course of this series, I'll be sitting down with three individuals from different nations to discuss their ideas surrounding Indigenous notions of kinship and its significance. The views shared by these individuals are not representative of all Indigenous peoples, nor their individual nations as a whole. Content warning. The following contains voices of strong Indigenous individuals that may risk unsettling the settler within. Listener's discretion is advised. Today I sat down to have a conversation with Dr. Sarah Hunt at the Museum of Anthropology.
I'm Sarah Hunt. I am Kwagil from the Kwakiwak people from Sahis or Fort Rupert on the northern part of the island. And I'm also Ukrainian English on my mom's side. I grew up in Songhees territory, otherwise known as Victoria, and lived there most of my life. And I just moved here last July to start a position in First Nations and Indigenous Studies. So I'm assistant professor in that department in geography. Now a guest here on Musqueam territories. So we're in the Museum of Anthropology on Musqueam territories. For me, this is an important place because historically my grandpa and my great-grandpa and my dad were all carvers in museums. So museums are places I've spent a lot of time, but this museum has a lot of our regalia, both things that would have been taken from our communities during the potlatch ban, but also new pieces that were created. So there's one regalia piece by George Hunt, who's a relative of mine. And museums for me are also often strange places because I feel like a kinship or sense of relationship with materials in them, which are on display, you know, in cases for people to look at, but also have a lot of personal significance and historic significance, not just in a vague sense like that belongs to my community, but actually my grandpa made that big Tundaqua mask or whatever, so a direct relationship. So I'm happy to be here today, and there's a lot of works here that are from all over the place, but some of them, for me, I always think of some of them were made for sale, but also a lot of them were made for ceremony, so they were never intended to be just out on display. They were intended to be used in cultural spaces. So.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's really important to note, because it is a funny space to kind of walk around and see what are our relations being almost studied, you know, taken in as artifacts by other people.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to note in relation with ideas around kinship, because so often Indigenous notions of kinship are misunderstood by others.
Right.
Like, these are just objects to them, but to us, they're family, they're more.
Yeah.
And they're not only our history, but they're important to us now.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean for you to be able to work here on Musqueam territory?
Yeah. For me, I think as a coastal person, I first think about our longstanding relationship that we might have had. So using the same waterways along the coast where I don't know a lot of the specifics, but knowing that there would be trading relationships and certainly travel between our communities. Of course, there's sometimes marriage or those kind of relationships. So yeah, I think about coming here as a guest and just the general teachings I have about being a good guest here. Historically, we probably would have asked to come ashore and waited for permission to do that. I did meet with people at Musqueam before I was offered the job, and for me that was important because First Nations and Indigenous Studies does have that relationship with Musqueam, which a lot of university programs don't, and not just here, but in lots of places where Indigenous community relationships are more general. It's not the people whose land we're on. So it's a great privilege to be here, and it's also, I have this connection through my dad's family, through my Quaggill family, but then it also makes me think about my responsibilities through the non-Indigenous side of my family too. For me, just being in a university, like when I was an undergraduate, was a very difficult place to be. I was usually the only Native student in the class, and that was at UVic, which at the time had about 50 Native students and now has like over 500 or 600, right? So a lot has changed in the last 20 years. So for me, it's wonderful to be able to be here, and I just feel really lucky all the time that I get to work with such passionate students and faculty.
You do have like a very firm grasp of the meaning to be on these lands as a guest, and I'm wondering if that in any other way shapes how you act on these lands and through practice or theory or any discussions in class or anything like that.
I try to always be cognizant of that here wherever I am, which is always on stolen land pretty much. I think that in general in my life I have like a real sense of ethics. I think a lot about my ethical responsibilities, not university ethics, but my own personal ethics. I think these come from teachings about the way that my responsibilities emerge out of my relationships. So my relationship through family and community, but also land-based relationships. So I think about how I can enact principles from my own cultural teachings here, but also how I can be attuned to what is required of me from Musqueam people. And that means educating myself. So it means kind of constantly naming, say in classes or other spaces that were on unceded territory, but going beyond that. So thinking about how, if whatever issues we're talking about are connected to dispossession or Musqueam resurgence, you know, cultural resurgence and political struggles and things. So it's about not having a sense of entitlement to this space in a way. It's not just like people talk sometimes about it being a privilege to be in university, which is true, and there's a responsibility that goes with that, but it's also knowing we wouldn't be here if it weren't for ongoing dispossession. So there's a real tension. We can't just say I recognize Musqueam people in words, but how do we do that in actions? And I think it means constant self-reflection, just knowing that we always have more education to do. I think it's a constant process. Like, it's a way of being here that is not based in entitlement, but knowing I'm a guest, and being a good guest means constant work. So
I often note that too, especially in these university settings where, you know, it's mentioned at the beginning of class every time, especially in bubbles outside of the FNIS program, and a lot of the times it falls on deaf ears, or they're more just empty words that faculty has to say. And the students, I don't think, understand the significance of that and how they're profiting off of ongoing colonial efforts. And I was going to ask you about feelings of home.
Yeah, for me, I do think that my feeling of home is usually at the shoreline. So when I felt disconnected or hopeless or something, I would go to the water. I think for me, when I look out into the ocean, I know my ancestors have seen that similar view for a long time. I also think there's so much going to hell and ambasking in the world that as long as the sort of waves, or if I can still hear that, then it's kind of okay. Like, I feel, have this feeling like the ocean, as much, you know, destruction as we're doing to the planet and to the ocean and everything living in it, that hopefully it will persevere. Like, I have this feeling of strength and also of not knowing. It reminds me that I actually can't conceive of the depth and hugeness of the ocean and what lies beneath. To me, that's actually comforting, because it kind of reminds me that we can't intellectualize everything. We can't know everything. You know, there's this colonial or imperial impulse to, like, claim to know, to solve things, to resolve them, to have authority. And it's just, to me, a reminder, I can't know. Like, I look out and I only see the surface, but I, you know, there's more complicated things happening underneath. And for me, that's something then, even though I might not, this might not be my home in the sense I'm not from here, I often go to the water because it actually extends to where my family's from, right? So the ocean is a place that makes me feel connected to that. So I think also, just to say, a lot of Indigenous theory comes from, they think, thinking about relation to land, but water is missing. And there has been work through, like, Hawaiian scholars have talked a lot about different ways of seeing the world in relation to water and the sky. And but we on the coast here have similar, or our own worldviews that are about the undersea world and the sky world. And when you think about those comprising our worldview, actually much more than land, like, we require ongoing relationships. There's a need to, like, I think there's a lot of exciting things we can do thinking more about what that means for who we are. So
no, that actually leads perfectly, because I was going to point out, so often these kinship relations in a lot of people's view are limited to person to person, and I wanted to note the exclusivity of that, because our relations are more than that. They're relations with yourself, with the lands, and as coastal peoples, I wanted to note the significance of our relations with the waters, as well as all the life in these spaces. So fish are so crucial in so many spaces. I was going to ask about maybe the influences on your ideas of kinship and relationship and the responsibilities that go along with these things in these spaces.
So for me, I grew up away from Tsahi, so I would go for potlatches and feasts and things to visit. But I don't know, I think that gives you a unique perspective when you move between space, because you can see kind of mainstream or Western cultural norms and then, like, our own cultural practices, because you're moving in spaces where they're happening and then not happening. I would always reflect on, you know, those things when I was growing up. I saw a lot of the way that I approach kind of relationality, not just my own, like, kinship and worldview, but my responsibilities and the relationality of the knowledge that I try to produce here, which is very much in connection with community and people who aren't represented here, kind of comes partly from the potlatch. So seeing the role of witnesses in ceremony, witnesses are paid to remember what's happened, not just to remember, like, a list, you know, first this happened and this happened, but to experience it. And then if anything's ever called into question in the future, those witnesses can be called on to recall what happened. And seeing as there's a whole room full of witnesses, there's multiple perspectives, right? Not everybody will remember things the same way. For me, it's been thinking about, in the relationships, the networks that I'm in, the relationships that I have, whether it's to people, whether it's, like, actually my Quaggill community, family members, or other spaces, that there are voices that are not heard as much or called into question or undermined. And my role, like, being witness, means that I have to recall and make note of their, like, the experiences that are being forgotten or left out. With people's consent, but where I'm asked to do that, that's how I think of my role, is more in that witnessing role. And a lot of what I've seen in the in my family and community doesn't follow what we think of as being, like, family. It's much more expansive than that. So it's very normal for kids to be raised by their grandparents or aunties, or for adoption to happen, or for people to live with each other and family, you know, that's not, like, on paper legally through the Canadian government. Doesn't make sense. And growing up on the Songhees Reserve, you know, I was surrounded by people I went to school with and their extended families, and I'm someone's godmother and know her extended family, and there's a real sense of kind of being embedded in community. So that people, my mom is not Indigenous, actually, she lives, but she's lived there for over 20 years, maybe almost 25, and she's very much, you know, if there's a funeral, she brings food. If there's a Looney Tooney to raise funds for the soccer tournament, she contributes, she goes, and people bring, you know, I'm always amazed, kids drop by to learn how to bake cookies, or people drop off fish when it's fish season. And to me, that's taught me a lot about how you can be in community or be in kinship in ways that are, again, like beyond just thinking about race. It's actually about lived relationships. So she's part of that community because she's been welcomed into it and invested her energy into cultivating those relationships. So for me, that's what I think about here. I just arrived here and it'll take a while to develop those relationships, right? But you have to be willing. It doesn't happen through formal agreements or something. You just show up at the funerals. You make food and bring it to people. You connect informally. And to me, that's where real relationship building happens.
It's important to note that you talk about family. And through this project, I've been having my own problems in approaching these topics because they're so varied and oftentimes so personal. I've been struggling with this idea in my head that I have to approach these things through almost an academic lens because right. This is an academic project and a research project. Approaching them in that way almost seems an imposition on a space of what is often more traditional forms of knowledge rather than colonial academic knowledge.
Right.
How do we navigate those conflicted ideas and have these discussions like this in thoughtful and meaningful ways?
I think that's a perfect question, because in my methodology class this week, we were talking about kind of indigenous versus decolonial epistemologies or knowledge, you know, what we consider knowledge, but also how that informs methodology, which is really just ways of doing things. For me, I know there are certain things that we have to do to be legitimized in academia, but I think a lot of work has been done, especially over the last 20 years, to bring Indigenous worldviews into these spaces so we don't have to make sense of them in the way we might have to do certain things like ethics procedures and, you know, there's certain rules. Mm-hmm. And they're in place for a reason. But in my PhD, I used witnessing methodology as the framework for my whole project. Coming from the potlatch, I still did my ethics review. You know, I still did all those institutional things. But there's a real ability to make sense of our lives on our own terms and bring them into conversation. To me, that's also theorizing. Like, people often think if you don't say it in academic words, it's not theory. But actually, like, if you talk to young people, they're theorizing their lives all the time. They might not use words that, like, Marx uses or Fanon or something, but they're going to use words that make sense to them. And then my role, say if I'm working with youth, is to bring that into conversation. Like, if youth want to be heard by policymakers, for example, how can I be true to what they're saying? And kind of, it's like a translation, I guess, right? And that's often what I think of what we can do as Indigenous academics is kind of a reclamation, but it's like all these tools have, like, research tools have been used to capture us for others. And instead to use those to foster our own reclamation. So even though we might, you know, you're using a modern technology and I use a computer and all those things, but we can do that, we can put those into practice in ways that support and further ways of being that might resonate with our ancestors. So I often think about Sisu, the sea serpent, which could change form. To me, like, I think about, what does that mean? We have to do that, right? We can shift and transform, and that's also an Indigenous concept, right? I think it's just making sense of it within our own worldview is really important, instead of trying to stick ourselves into the Western kind of frameworks for what research is or whatever. So I think more about, like, the pluralism of those forms of knowledge or ways of relating. So it's, I don't think it's either or, you know? We have to make sense of these dominant systems. We can do that at the same time as we're fostering our own. Like, you're a member of the community. So, like, you might have a role as an academic, but you have a role, you're a community member. So that's where the shape-shifting or multiple identities or whatever resonate with our ancestors.
Ways we can honor and respect and practice these critical bonds in conflicted spaces like universities and specifically the MOA. No, I think we're kind of doing that right now by being here and having this discussion in this space. But do you think they affect these relations in any way?
These spaces?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do think that, for me, it's in the everyday ways that we think about kinship. So, you know, I think about Glenn, my coworker. We're kin in some ways, right? Like, I think about Daniel. I think about all of us as being in community together. There's certain responsibilities that if we think about each other, maybe there's multiple meanings of kin. For example, talking about, like, two-spirit people or youth or people who are street involved, or, like, a lot of people are pushed to the margins in our communities and their voices are not heard in leadership conversations. conversations or at negotiation tables or in policy conversations or whatever tend to be like turned into certain kind of subjects and research in these institutional spaces. I try to think of my relationships there as being kinship relations, in that I have an obligation to nurture those relationships, that we all have an obligation to do that, because the way that people become vulnerable, because my work has been around violence for a long time, violence is fostered through the lack of connections that we have and the stigma around different things, street involvement or whatever, for example. So I think about, like, you know, there's this sort of pan-Indigenous saying about all my relations. If we mean all my relations, if everybody's lives are valuable in our communities, then to me it's about like listening to and hearing and respecting everybody's voices the way that we should with our actual family members. You know, I use words around, like, I talk about people as our kin to bring people into closer relation. So I do work around, as I said, people who are involved in sex work. I think about the folks I work with as being my relation, because it's about mending the gaps that have been created, which I think helps to reduce harm. And for lots of people who are studied or talked about as being marginalized, including all Indigenous people are talked about as being marginalized, it creates a distancing. It's like an othering, right? And so how can we think about each other as, like, often I talk about non-Indigenous people then as like our neighbors. It's still about relation, but there's a difference than talking about kin, even though I do have non-Indigenous kin too. but, you know, it's how do we have good relations as neighbors, and also how do we foster relations as kin? And for me, those are not about blood. It's really about a form of relationship that comes from my sense of responsibility and ethics. So,
due to a tour making its way through the museum, we decided to take our discussion outdoors to continue our dialogue.
Through many forms of colonization, specifically targeting kinship ties and relations,
yeah,
like ceremony, well, arguably, most importantly, language,
mm-hmm,
they've been targeted for destruction and extinguishment.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we reconcile those damages that have happened and are still happening, actually, through dispossession of land, like,
yeah,
displacement, our relations with the land have been disrupted. I was wondering how we reconcile those.
The answer is going to depend on where you are and who you are. I think that people are resisting all of those things on all fronts. So for me, it's always important to remember that colonization is an unfinished project and that it wasn't successful. We didn't die off. We didn't stop practicing our traditions. We didn't stop speaking our language, even though we have a lot to recuperate. There's definitely a lot of loss, but we are shifting and adapting and constantly negotiating and making sense of the new conditions that we're in. So, and also the conditions and the strategies change all the time. That's part of the tactic of colonialism, is fighting on one front and then shifting to another front, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if we can reconcile that. I think that we have to just keep resisting that destruction all the time. And I think that it's important that we can do these things in our everyday lives. It doesn't necessarily take a large-scale strategy. It can be done on a more everyday level. I do think that we have to also write about our lives in ways that's not just about those losses, but about the strength. That is about the resistance. So wherever there's, you know, violence or abuse or destruction, there's always resistance to that. Always. And it's important also to disrupt the discourses that represent us just as marginalized and hurt and colonized and, you know, those kinds of subjects, that we have agency, that we are using it in lots of different ways, and that there's no one right way to do that. So, you know, some people see negotiating with the state as a good tactic. Others, they reject that.
Yeah.
Whatever your tactic is, I think that I try to avoid kind of pitting people against each other or divisive kind of tactics, because I think that works in the favor of colonization. So it's more about connecting and fostering relationships in a multitude of ways. So.
The implementation of patriarchal hierarchies and governance systems,
mm-hmm,
is also definitely a form of violence. And I was wondering, because they're so ingrained, it's,
yeah,
seen as tradition now,
right,
in so many communities.
Mm-hmm.
You see resistance in terms of that? And
yeah, lots of ways. I think that a lot of the resistance has not been made visible until recently in academic terms. But I think that if we look at Indigenous people, communities, families, but especially, of course, Indigenous women resisting the imposition of forms of governance that denied them any voice or leadership. That's been happening all along. I think it has happened in small ways. I often think about, you know, the more intimate scales of resistance or even cultural practices often are not visible outside the spaces in which they're happening. So if you're not part of that network, you won't know about it. But certainly from the early days of trying to take kids away to residential school, families were hiding their kids, or there's always been resistance. So I think that looking to the works of people who are maybe not, like now there's kind of this development of the field of Indigenous feminism, but before that, before those words were being used, there were people writing stories, people writing about, you know, how their lives have been shaped through the imposition of patriarchal legal terms in the Indian Act and the on-the-ground impact that's had. I do think one big gap that we don't see a lot being written about, certainly it's being lived and talked about, though, is how reserve governance happens. You know, there's a lot of focus on like negotiating at the federal level, like with the AFN, like their role or those kind of organizations. But on the ground every day, young people are, or all of us, are often most affected by the little things that happen, right? In the day-to-day kind of decisions, the way that power operates in a band office or on the reserve. And because of the imposition of patriarchal forms of governance and just men having for so long roles within the band system and not women weren't allowed, that there are still ways that power is held that perpetuates that. So if we think about like a lot of the smaller communities, there's resistance happening, but there can be a lot of silencing because of the everyday ways that violence happens and, you know, gender dynamics. And I know some communities I've worked with, people have tried to speak out, and if there's an abuser in a position of power, that's just the reality. Like, that is true in some of our communities, that can have really violent consequences. People lose their housing or their job in the band office or whatever. So that's something I think we need to do more truth telling about that and try to find ways of changing those norms. It's really about holding each other accountable.
Yeah.
And that can really only happen from within. I don't know that writing a book or doing a research thing on it, it really has to come from the communities, you know, to support people who are trying to make change, supporting that.
Of course. There's also responsibilities to one another. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to these ideas of responsibility in relation with Indigenous women, LGBTQ, and Two-Spirit people mm-hmm. in these communities, and where these responsibilities are being taken up in thoughtful, meaningful ways.
I do think that there are networks of people who are taking responsibility for just normalizing the diversity of ways of being Indigenous. That includes diversity of genders and diversity of sexualities. And there are lots of networks of people who are, well, A, just living their lives, being who they are, being fabulous. And I think that there is a long tradition of people thinking critically about gender and indigeneity, sexuality and indigeneity, both creatively, like in the arts and in the academy, in community, just living their lives, on the ground organizing lots of different ways, that does not necessarily appear in a lot of academic work. It's maybe been peripheral to that. Certainly conversations about gender, I mean, are very present in some parts of Indigenous studies, but we still have a lot of work to do. And I think that one of the main things that we need to come to terms with is that when the Indian Act, for example, was imposed, it wasn't just about race and wasn't just about deterritorializing Indigenous people and turning us into Indians. It was gendered. There was always a gendered component right from the start, to create a hierarchy that imposed a certain kind of power in our communities. And decolonization has to involve the disruption of those forms of power as gendered, not just as being about state and land. Yeah, that there are and were culturally specific ways of thinking about gender roles that was not about, you know, you're a girl so you like Barbies and you're going to wear pink. It was about you're going to be a wife, and it was about very culturally specific, right? So there are definitely gender roles that are about male and female roles, but there's also a huge diversity of other kinds of roles. And those roles are all essential for the maintenance of our different cultural practices, whether you're Kwakwaka'wakw or your Plains Cree or whatever, right? That there's a diversity. So I think that recovering, like, a lot of the language to represent, talk about those things, that's still a work in progress. But lots of work is being done by people, individuals especially, who are trying to make sense of their lives as both Indigenous and whatever, whether they consider themselves Two-Spirit or even just as a woman. As a Kwakiwak woman, what does that mean? You know, what is my role in terms that, again, isn't just about men and women, like power between men and women, but that's actually connecting my role to my culture. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot of work to do there, but there are already a lot of people who are thinking and talking about these things. So there's a good legacy to draw from.
No, I think it's awesome that you mentioned that, you know, allowing ourselves those victories in these spaces through these amazing people doing this work, because it's so possible to re-traumatize through all these, you know, these focuses on only the damaging aspects of what's happened and what is happening. I think it's beautiful that you hold these people in such high esteem. You know, you mentioned things like people doing their work in the arts and everything like that, and you're doing work in geographies. And I think it's important to have discussions in spaces like that, because, you know, people never really link decolonizing methodologies with things like the sciences or like geographies. No, I think you're somebody who's doing amazing work in those spaces, and it's incredibly crucial. These discussions of kinship and tying all these decolonization methodologies together helps. I was wondering if you could maybe speak a bit about kinship as a decolonizing methodology.
Yes. For me, I just think of it as relationality, that there's a quality of Indigenous knowledge and indigeneity at all that is about a lived, active relationality. So that means it can change through time, that it depends on who you're in relation with, but that we have certain principles that we can use to guide us. And for me, that's really exciting, because it means that as we face new challenges, we still have this foundation to draw upon.
It's amazing. I want to thank you very much. That means a lot to me that you wanted to participate in this project.
Thank you. Thanks for asking. It's great.